Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program that addresses the ramifications of change and today's choices, how they'll affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities, an organization committed to identifying and carrying out projects that will improve the quality of life in San Luis Obispo County. The show's topics and guests focus on raising public awareness about local and regional concerns and is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. At a recent report released in September, the National Health Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine released Families Caring for an Aging America. And they cited that by 2013, 72.8 million Americans, or more than one in five, will be 65 years or older. The greatest growth will be among the old, who are typically in the most need of help. The number in that group, those in their 80s and above, will soar from 27% in 2012 to 37% by 2050. At the same time that more caregivers will be needed in the United States, fewer will be available. The reasons? Americans are having fewer children, more aging adults have no children, and there have been decreases in the ranks of never married and divorced. Those who have children may live farther away than they did from generations past. What's more, Medicare and private insurance payers have adopted financial incentives to get patients discharged more quickly from hospitals and often into the hands of caregivers who feel ill-equipped to do what's necessary to keep them healthy. That often includes being in charge of things like feeding tubes, drainage tubes, catheters, and other kinds of medical things that they may not be familiar or comfortable with. So what if families can't take care of their loved ones safely? Who can and will? What are the alternatives? Is there a system in place? Today we're going to be taking a deeper look at those questions with my guest. She is Karen Jones, Executive Director and Program Manager for Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services of San Luis Obispo County. The show is live, and we invite you to join our conversation with your comments and questions, and you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, to call into the show, it's 781-3875. And Karen, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Chris.
First, you know, the term ombudsman, I think we've heard it from time to time, and I know you've been on the show in the past, but for those people that haven't really heard an explanation, what does the Ombudsman Services do?
Well, in particular, I operate the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program here in San Luis Obispo County. There are a lot of ombudsmen out there. That basically is a word that means citizen's advocate. And so there's child abuse ombudsman, there's court ombudsman, there's Cal Poly, I believe, has an ombudsman. So there's a lot of different types of ombudsman. There's even a mobile home ombudsman. But we are the long-term care. So our clients are folks who live in or will be soon living in a long-term care facility like a nursing home or a residential care facility for the elderly, also known as assisted living. And we are the folks who can investigate complaints and try to resolve those. We give information and referrals, and we really just try to improve the quality of life in care facilities in the area.
So what is your role as an ombudsman? What does an ombudsman do? You say that it acts as an advocate. How do you do that? Can you give an example of what your role would be if somebody was in a long-term care facility? Give a theoretical scenario.
Sure. So, you know, we may have somebody who's in a care facility who doesn't like to make complaints, doesn't like to make waves, doesn't like to get someone in trouble, but they're not happy with something happening in the facility. For instance, the food is coming, you know, the hot items are cold and the cold items are warm. And there's not always a lot to do in facilities, so food can be really important. They're also really important to good health. If your food's not adequate, you may not eat enough. You can have health declines, especially if you have medications, and your medications require you to have some good sustenance inside of you. There can just be some real negatives to having a food issue. So the person may not want to complain, but they want it fixed. And so we can help them, you know, tell them what their rights are, what they can do to fix it if they'd like to, or we can actually go down and talk to the cooking department, the chef area, talk to the management of the facility, especially if we're getting complaints from more than one person. And maybe the problem is their system has broken down and they're putting the food on the trays too soon, long before it's delivered. Or maybe the problem is the equipment isn't working and the carts that are supposed to deliver the items at the right temperature, it's not happening. So we can help look at those systems and see if there's a way they can improve them. We can also, you know, maybe encourage somebody to eat more in a group dining room where they can get their meal sooner than in their bedroom. It's also good for socialization. So there's a lot of things that we can do, and that's a pretty simple situation. We also do a lot when there's family issues, when there's roommate conflicts, when there's care issues. We can help people with just about anything that can occur in inside a care facility.
Now, to clarify, you don't work for the facilities.
No, we are completely independent. We're a state and federal organization. We have state and federal legislation. We are in San Luis County. We happen to be a nonprofit organization. The name of the nonprofit is Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services of San Luis Obispo County. And we have the grants and the contract to provide that service to the community. In other parts of California, it may be a county-based agency. And so we have the nonprofit here. We also work with the California Department of Aging. There's a state ombudsman who is appointed by the governor to be the head of the agency. And then we have federal law, and we're part of the it's now the Administration on Community Living. Formerly, it was just the Administration on Aging at the federal level.
And the ombudsman that you have working for you are volunteers?
Yeah, we have three staff persons, and then we have about 20 volunteers. We don't, other than it may be a radio show, we typically don't call them volunteers because there is an expectation sometimes that people are worth what they're paid. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we pay mileage, but we don't really pay somebody a salary if they're a volunteer ombudsman. We call all of our ombudsmen, that, you know, whether they get a salary or not doesn't matter. And frankly, I couldn't afford the ombudsman that we have. We have a lot of very high-quality folks, retired hospital administrators, retired pharmacists.
Nurses, attorneys.
Everything. Yeah. You know, we have really quality people. We have some people who come from maybe a more normal background. You know, I've got a few folks who've raised children and stayed in the home, and what they contribute is amazing because they have so much background in some of what we're doing. So it's so helpful to us to have those 20 people out in those facilities and getting in there on a regular basis, two or three times a week in a nursing home, two or three times a month in residential care, so we can get to know the resident and that they trust us and will talk to us.
So the ombudsman round on the various facilities in the county on a weekly basis?
Oh, yes. We're in the facilities a lot. And again, it's mostly because, you know, in America, culturally, if you didn't know me and I was to say to you, "Hi, Chris, how are you doing?" there would be one answer.
I'm fine.
You're fine. Mm-hmm. But of course you're not fine. You clearly mm-hmm. have a bit of a cold still. You know, maybe something's happening with your pets. You may have a child that you're concerned about. But most of us don't tell strangers all of our problems.
Right.
Some people do. But most of us, we keep our problems to ourselves until we know that we can trust you with our issues and that you're not going to cause us some kind of harm by us discussing them with you. So that's why it's so important that we go to the facilities, we do monitoring visits, and we're looking for health and safety issues, but we're also looking to get to know those residents so they'll trust us with their worries and their concerns, and we can try to help make sure that those things stop being a worry and a concern, that they get fixed.
And the ombudsmen are assigned to certain facilities, so the same ombudsman goes back to that facility on a regular basis?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Most of our ombudsmen, unless they have a life change, really stay with us for a very long time. Mm-hmm. We have one ombudsman, I kind of tease her because she's been with us for about 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have quite a few ombudsmen who are nearing the 20-year mark. And I think they might think they get to retire soon. Of course, I always forbid that, but they'd ignore me. And we also have some folks who've been with us about 4 years now. So we're always looking to increase the number of volunteers so that we can increase our services. But and we don't force people to stay for 20 years. It's not a 20-year commitment. But most folks, once they're in the program, they really enjoy what they're doing. It's not an envelope stuffing opportunity. It's not always easy. It's not always fun. But it is so incredibly gratifying to make a difference for somebody and to know that we're making an improvement.
So if a family member was concerned about something like their family members not being showered or not being dressed, or, you know, they feel like they're not getting the right care, and they've gone to the care team and they've said, this is a concern for me and it hasn't been addressed. Is that a concern that could be brought to an ombudsman?
Absolutely. And we're always happy to tell somebody how they can resolve it themselves first.
Correct.
And they get to decide what level of participation we're going to have. So they can call me or call the office, and we will say, here's what your rights are. Here's what the facility has to do. Here's what the requirements are. And from there, they can decide, do they want to deal with it themselves first? And if they don't fix it, then perhaps we can come and have a meeting with them and the staff. Or are they afraid of retaliation? So maybe they want just us to handle that issue, and we'll go deal with talk to the management and try to get that resolved. The most important thing to remember, though, is sometimes family members want something different than the resident, the person who's living in the care facility.
Could you give me an example of what you're talking about?
Well, going to your shower situation. So right. Family says, look, my loved one needs to be showered 3 times a week.
Right.
And the resident says, I don't really want to be showered 3 times a week, or they have dementia and showering is a nightmare for them.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of seniors, it's terribly frightening with especially Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
A lot of seniors grew up in places where you took a shower or a bath once or twice a week at the most, you know, Saturday night before going to church on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept of showering more often really confuses them, because sometimes they can't remember why they're having 2 or 3 Saturday nights in the same week, especially in the daytime,
right?
Because Saturday night was bath time. So it can be very hard on them, or they might not, if they are competent, they may just not choose to have a shower that often. So we're going to go to the resident first and make sure what they want and try to resolve that issue if that's the problem. And after that, we're going to go back to the facility and say, look, the resident does want a shower 2 or 3 times a week. How can we make sure that gets to happen?
How does the ombudsman interact with, say, state licensing? State licensing actually has jurisdiction, correct, over licensed agencies. Do you work together in tandem? Do you, you know, are you independent? If something isn't resolved, then does it become a licensing issue? Are there different levels of concern that go in different directions?
Right. So, ombudsman, we're partners in a sense with the licensing agencies,
right,
just like we're partners in a sense with the care facilities. I'd say we have a love-hate relationship with all the licensing folks. The licensing folks love us when we resolve a problem and they don't need to come out and deal with that.
Okay.
It's taken care of, the resident's happy and satisfied, and things are going well. They really dislike us, though, when we say to the licensing agency, you haven't done enough. You know, this is a big problem and you need to fix this. You need to get out here right away. It's an emergency. And sometimes they don't like it because we're pushing them to do stuff they might not really want to do, but we think they really need to do that. So it's a working relationship. We have regular meetings with licensing staff. Ombudsmen aren't licensing light, though. We're not like, you know, the sugar-free version of licensing agencies. We don't have punishment powers. We have nothing we can do if a facility will not cooperate with us, will not fix a problem. There's nothing I can do as an ombudsman to make that facility do it.
Right.
But I can reach out to those licensing agencies, and they do have punishment power. And if the problem is a violation of a state or federal regulation, then they can get a deficiency or a citation or a fine, or ultimate extreme would be that they would get closed down. That's never our preference. We want facilities open and providing good care.
Karen, how many facilities are in San Luis Obispo County that your ombudsman oversee and visit on a weekly basis?
So there's 8 nursing homes. 7 of those are long-term, and there's about 800 available beds at any given time, but they're usually pretty full. In residential care, or what we sometimes call assisted living, there's about 100 facilities with about 1,000-ish beds, 1,500 beds. And, you know, at any time, there's usually more availability in the residential facilities. But most of those are private pay. There's not like Medi-Cal or Medicare doesn't cover the cost of those places.
And the assisted living facilities, there are different levels of assisted living facilities. There are smaller ones, larger ones.
Yes, and for better or worse, they have all the same licensing regulations,
okay,
with just a few caveats for when a large size facility may have slightly more regulations than a smaller one. But they're all pretty much the same licensing requirements. So we have 4-bed facilities. It looks like a house, or a 6-bed facility. You may not even know you have a care facility next to you because, you know, they tend not to be having frat parties or something like that. They're pretty quiet places. And then there's places that you'll see that are very large, like Garden Creek or Mance on Marsh or Brookdale or Wyndham. They look like big apartment complexes, and there's a lot of seniors in there. And each type of facility fits a different need. So if you have someone who's got a lot of dementia, or is physically very disabled and not able to get around very well, a large apartment-style place may not be a good spot. But if you have someone who's fairly physically able-bodied, doesn't have a whole lot of confusion going on or memory loss, and is pretty social, likes to go to activities and do a lot of stuff and be part of a group, they're going to do better in maybe an apartment-style setting than into a 6-bed place where they might not be able to talk to very many people. So we try to work with families on how to choose the type of facility that might be best for their person.
In the ballpark, now, long-term care facilities, the ones that are licensed as long-term care, does Medicare pay for that?
Medicare will pay for a skilled nursing facility if you can get into them pretty quickly, within 30 days, but usually immediately after hospitalization, if you need rehab therapy. And that would be speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, something like that. You know, I always thought occupational therapy without getting a job. And I would say, well, these people have been retired for many years. Why are we getting them prepped for a job? But it turns out occupational therapy is about how you do things around your home to make it functional for you.
Right.
So you may need to relearn how to do laundry because one of your arms isn't working as well or something like
after
that.
After a stroke or something.
Something, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you need some type of therapy, then you can go to a nursing home for up to 100 days. It is very hard to get 100 days of therapy. And the facility really has to work to prove why you would need that. So most people get 20 days or a couple of weeks. They may get 40
Meaning
days.
That Medicare approves payment for those 20 days.
Right. And Medicare does pay the first 20 days 100%. And after that, the next 80 days is they pay 80%. So your secondary insurance, long-term care insurance, or private pay you pay out of pocket would cover the rest of that 20%.
When you say that it's from a hospital admission, for an individual, say that it's a family who's taking care of a loved one, and that person has declined significantly where they're just really needing round-the-clock care. The family cannot care for them anymore. Can they transfer that person into a skilled nursing facility and have Medicare pay for it?
No, not unless they've been admitted to a hospital for 3 days prior.
And it has to be at least 3 days that the person is admitted in the hospital.
Yeah, they need to be there for 3 midnights. And you have to make sure they're admitted and not there under observation. That's a huge controversial problem because sometimes people be in a hospital for a week.
Under observation.
And it looks like they're admitted. They're being treated by the nursing staff. They're being given medication. They're having tests run. That just like their person in the room next to them or the bed next to them. But it turns out they're there under observation and not admitted to the hospital. And you have to clarify that upon admission. When you move into a hospital for a short time, first thing you have to do is clarify, are you admitted or under observation? Because it makes a very big difference whether or not a nursing home is an option from there.
What would be a reason that a person would be kept under observation rather than admission?
It goes back to Medicare saving money. You know, there's a lot of people needing Medicare, and the premiums aren't that expensive. So it's a system that they're trying to keep flush with cash so that it can meet the needs. And so if you don't meet certain criteria medically, if you're not truly needing to be in a hospital, then you may be under observation. And I don't have all the criteria. I let the Medicare and the hospital folks figure that out. But you may not quite meet the definition, but you may be sick enough that it's okay to stay there. Just not quite enough to be truly admitted for Medicare reasons.
Is this something that you run into as a challenge? I know you get a lot of phone calls from people that are kind of in a quandary with their elderly loved ones trying to figure out what's the best and the safest place. What are some of the issues that you run into frequently?
Well, the observation issue has resolved itself a little bit. When it first happened a few years ago and it started hitting, it became a national problem, that was really challenging because the hospitals weren't really sure what to do yet, so they weren't telling people what their status was. Now they are required from the beginning to tell you what your status is, but if they don't, find out. So we don't get that as often. Mm-hmm. When we do, they're very hard cases because normally there's someone who truly needs to get into a nursing home, but now they're just like any other transfer from home or from community into a nursing home. At that point, your private pay or Medi-Cal, Medicare won't cover that. And the difference is Medicare pays more than $500 a day for those rehab therapy services for you to be there. Medi-Cal pays about $5,000 a month for you to be there. And private pay costs about $7,000 a month. So, you know, you can imagine Medicare is the ideal situation. You don't have to be a math wizard or an MBA to figure out if you run a business, you want to go with the highest income possible, and that's going to be the Medicare folks.
Right.
So people trying to get placed from the community, they've, like you said, they've gotten overwhelmed. They're looking for, they need placement. Their loved one doesn't have $7,000 a month or doesn't have enough money to go into residential care, which in our area costs between $2,500 to $7,000 or $8,000 a month, with an average, I'd say, around $3,000 or $4,000 for cost, depending on the type of place.
On top of the monthly amount?
In residential care, it's typically around $3,000. Yeah. So if somebody doesn't have that kind of money, they need to be in a nursing home because they need care. Now it's challenging because there's not a lot of beds here. In LA, you can always find a facility. There's lots of facilities, lots of openings. Here, we have about 95 to 99% occupancy in those nursing homes at any given time. So there's long waiting lists, and people typically are desperate. They don't get on a waiting list at a nursing home because what the heck, that might be fun. They need the care.
Right.
And so by the time you even know you need to be in a nursing home, getting on a waiting list is challenging. You just don't have the time to wait.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX, your public radio station. This is our fall pledge drive here at KCBX, and we're reaching out for your support. There are so many amazing volunteers who donate their time to bring you talk and local music shows, and you're enjoying a lot of them. I know that just people that have called in and said that they've enjoyed some of the local broadcasting has been wonderful, and the donations have been wonderful. You can offset some of the hard costs, however, that volunteers volunteering their time can't help out with. And we need your financial support to continue to keep KCBX bringing you all of the fantastic programming, both international, national, and local, that we've been doing. If you can, please call now at 549-8855 or donate online at kcbx.org. Neil started a great trend this morning with one of the best pledge drives that we've had in a day. If you can continue that trend, it would be fantastic. We can get through with pledge drive faster than Saturday. And every dollar that you bring into Pledge Drive, if you can give a little, give a lot, it would be a great benefit for the whole radio station. You're listening to Central Coast Voices, and we're talking about what is happening for America's society as it ages. The cost of care paid through Medicare continues to soar. And there are currently gaps in care payment that families are often unaware of and gaps that they fall into. My guest is Karen Jones, Executive Director and Program Manager for Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services in San Luis Obispo. And we're talking about some of the more common misconceptions about Medicare coverage and long-term care. Today's show is live, and we invite you to join our discussion. If you have questions or comments, or maybe you have a question about your own personal circumstances, you can call and talk with Karen at 805-781-3875. Again, to call in, it's 781-3875. What You know, aside, what are some of the, you know, talking about misconceptions, what are some of the more common misperceptions that you run into about care for the frail elderly and Medicare coverage?
Well, I think a lot of people think the government pays for all of that. You just call somebody and it gets paid for. You maybe have to do some work, but it'll happen. And really, for the most part, it doesn't. There's some funds available through VA services, veteran services mm-hmm. for veterans that may help. Some folks have long-term care insurance. Some of the policies are good, some not good. And then there's, you know, cash out of pocket. If you happen to be so fortunate to have sold a house or saved a lot of money, you may be able to do something like that. But a lot of people think there's just it just gets paid for. Something will happen. Your insurance will cover it or Medicare will pay for it.
And because we've paid into Social Security and worked and retired, that somehow that has already been paid for.
Right. It seems like it's a benefit we should expect.
Right.
And I'm not sure we shouldn't expect that. But mm-hmm. it isn't a benefit we have now.
That we're getting.
And we're probably not going to get it soon because with the boomers coming in, there's going to be a lot more need for these types of facilities
right.
and even less opportunity to get them paid for. I think the saddest call I get is when somebody calls me up and they're beyond frustrated as a caregiver. They've tried working through the system. They've tried finding, you know, help. They've tried getting into facilities. And they say, I'm just going to turn my loved one over to the state.
And is there a state to turn a loved one over to?
There really isn't. I'd have to say the state of California isn't known for sending around the granny mobile to come pick somebody up and take them away, and they're going to be in charge. The government is not prepared to take over the lives of the elderly. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
In certain extreme cases, the county can do a conservatorship and take over legal and financial powers over a person. But those are truly extreme cases. They are not the norm. And I would say maybe 1 in 1,000 phone calls, maybe 1 in 10,000. It's really rare that the county of San Luis Obispo is going to take over the lives of a frail senior who's got dementia or some other disability. It truly falls to the families to figure things out and to really cobble together something. A lot of people think there's a safety net. You know, we all expect a safety net. If you get in a car crash, you call 911, people will come and rescue. Fire will come, an ambulance and police. If you, if you have anything happen, if you expect that there's ultimately someone who will come and save that. You'll try, but you may need some help. It's not really true with senior care. I mean, Ombudsman, we try very hard to, when people call me for information, how do you work the system, we will give them as much help as we can. I have people come into my office all the time. Their loved one is not in a care facility. They may never get into a care facility, but we're going to help them with whatever services we can connect them to as much as we can along the way. But there's really no case management. There's no one you can call up and say, hey, my loved one needs help. They can't coordinate, you know, finding senior nutrition services or home-delivered meals or social workers to come and see them and help them with certain things. There's really no agency right now doing that for your average person. Certain agencies might have case management for a short time. But if you're an elderly person with some health issues and you don't have the ability to make phone calls to everybody and do a good job of that, and you don't have family members who are able because they don't live here or they're just have too much going on.
And they don't know what's available here because they're different in different communities, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's really challenging, and you may do without a lot of basic needs because you don't mm-hmm. know how to coordinate that. And
yeah.
We really need case management here. We need some agency that does not charge who can go out and help people who don't have the resources to pay for that service to coordinate the services that they need so that they can be healthy and in their homes longer.
Yeah, you mentioned without charge. There are agencies that will do it for a fee. There are individuals that will do the case management, but you need to be able to pay for that case management unless you happen to be getting case managed through, say, a home health agency, a hospice agency, an organization where you're receiving services that provides it, correct?
Right. So there are private businesses who mm-hmm. do case management. And what case management really means is coordinating services.
Right.
They're going to make sure you're getting the stuff you need, the services, the mm-hmm. whatever it may be, home caregivers, you know, placement in a facility. They're going to make sure your insurance is paying what they have to pay. They're going to sort of do all the stuff a well-informed family member would do. But they're going to charge. And the charges can be anywhere from $50 an hour to $100-plus dollars an hour, which is reasonable for what they're providing.
Sure.
But it's not reasonable for somebody with $1,200 a month of income who's barely staying in their home and also needs to purchase food and, you know, take care of the bills.
Right.
So for those folks, it's out of reach. It simply isn't possible to pay for that service. Mm-hmm. And if they happen to have home health and social workers are coming from home health, they may not have the service for very long. It may be 6 weeks, 10 weeks, but then they're back without the service again. They don't have a social worker coming after they're done with home health. And home health isn't forever.
Right.
And it's also not for everybody. If you can still drive but not do a good job of it, and you may not be able to even get home health because you're still mobile.
Right.
So it's tough right now in this area to get the extra help you need to coordinate so you can get the help you need.
Okay. We have a call from Diane from Lompoc. Diane, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. Did you have a comment or question?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
I had cancer when I was 28, and they had to take out my uterus. They left my ovaries because I was 28. In 03, I had to have my stomach and my gallbladder out, and so I have one-third of my stomach, which was like a radical stomach bypass.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found a doctor in Santa Barbara who did some skin removal, but he didn't do any liposuction. Two doctors since then said, I have been butchered. I feel skin dropping. I have rashes. I have, I feel ripping and tearing. And I'm having problems with the excess skin. I've seen, I call doctors that will take Medicare. I tell them that I was a marketing supervisor, by the way, and the money that they took out for Social Security, they didn't give it to the government. Also, I put some money into the stock market and Enron, and I lost over $400,000. So I live on $949 a month.
Uh-huh.
So when I call a Medicare doctor, I ask them, do you need any money up front? No. So, okay, I make the appointment. I go in. I talk to them. I asked all these questions, and I've seen every doctor in Santa Barbara that does skin removal that'll take Medicare. And I walk out of there, and they say, you give us $8,000 to $50,000 deposit. When Medicare pays us, we'll give you your money back. And then they bill Medicare from $2,000 to $4,500, $5,000 for that office visit. Well, and I have asked up front, and I'm very, very upset that Medicare is being billed for all these. They could do this all week long and not have to do anything else.
Well, Diane, I think we're talking about, you know, what we're talking about today is we're talking about the frail elderly and them trying to get into long care facilities. And it sounds like your situation is really frustrating, and I can really appreciate that.
Yeah, and the thing is,
but
I think, to LA.
Diane, one of the things that I would suggest is that you might want to call HICAP, and that
I already did that.
Okay.
No help.
That's something that Karen wouldn't be able to help you with, but what you can do is you can call 785-0132. And that probably would be a place you can call Karen at that office, and maybe she can get you connected with someone that could help you with getting some resolution. Okay?
But not till after the show's over, because I'm here.
Yeah, we're going to go on with the show and talk about it, the topic for today.
Oh, okay.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, so it is frustrating with Medicare for people, but we're, you know, what we'll get back to today is talking a little bit about seniors, the elder seniors. And Karen, with some of the frail elderly, what about facilities that will take memory care patients? Do all facilities accept memory care patients?
No, not all facilities.
And will Medicare pay for that?
Medicare, again, will only pay for if you've come out of the hospital for 3 days in the hospital and then you go to a nursing home. If you need to go to residential care, and let me maybe explain what the difference is.
Right.
So residential care is you need supervision. You may need, it's a licensed type facility. It's not a in theory, it's a non-medical facility. They typically don't have nurses on duty. They have doctors who may come in once in a while to see you, but they're not really part of the staff. You're not getting a medical component. They can still manage your medication. They can still give it to you as ordered by a doctor. They can, help you with bathing and dressing and eating and all that stuff. But they're really not there to do anything medical, and they're not trained for that. And a lot of more high-end medical needs, decubitus ulcers, known as bed sores or wounds, certain catheter care, diabetics. If you need your blood sugar tested and can't do that yourself, or if you need insulin injections or any type of injection, they can't really do that in residential care. And so a skilled nursing facility means you need to have a nurse around 24/7. Mm-hmm. All the time, you need at least one nurse, an LVN or an RN, at all times, because your medical condition requires that level of monitoring or supervision. And so those are the differences. And then, of course, there's some other differences. But those, for most of us, that's what matters. You know, how do you pick one? That's the issue. So if you're, at home and you've got memory issues and your loved ones think you need to be placed in a facility, you can go to residential care. But again, most of that's going to be out of pocket. So it means you're going to have to pay somewhere between $2,000 and $7,000 a month. And if you wander, if you have a tendency to get lost, if you go out that front door and you're going to go find home, even though you were home, but you don't recall that as your home because of your memory, you're probably going to need a locked facility. And that's going to be the higher costing one.
And does Medicare pay for?
No Medicare for that. If you're, again.
So a facility like Sydney Creek is not reimbursed by Medicare?
No. Again, those are going to be out of your pocket. They can keep you safe so you don't wander, but they're not going to be something that your checkbook will be safe from because you're going to have to use
that. You know, and in this day and age, one of the things that, I've read is happening more and more is a lot of the baby boomer generation, there's a lot that have their, their nest egg has been in their home or homes. And so what happens if someone has their money in their home but really doesn't have the assets to be able to, say, pay $7,000 a month and they need to go into facility?
Right. And that's the million-dollar question. What do you do when you need some care?
Right.
You maybe don't need a lot, but you need enough because you're not safe at home. And now you need to be placed, but you don't have the money. You don't have the liquid assets. Or even if you sold your home, you don't have, it may be your nest egg, but we've been through one pretty big recession where the bubble popped and we may have another one coming. Who knows? Maybe you pulled out some cash because people tell you to do that. If you don't have more than $50,000 in equity in your home that you will net after a sale or with, then, you're really not going to be able to stay in a facility for very long because it's going to cost
a lot. Not at $7,000 a month.
No, that goes very quickly. You may be able to get a reverse mortgage. That's a possibility depending on your age, but you have to stay in your home for that.
Right.
Which means bringing in caregivers. And private caregiving agencies charge somewhere around $25 an hour.
Does Medicare pay for that?
No. Again, out of your pocket. So it's pricey to... It's pricey to get old and broken. It's okay to be older, but broken and older, that's a bad combination for your checkbook. And, saving for a rainy day is great, but boy, it's just thundering and pouring when you start getting dementia involved.
When you start getting it frail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're going to take a call here from Alexandra. Are you there?
I am here.
Hi. You had a question or comment?
Yeah, I wanted your... listeners to hear part of my story because I was taking care of my mother with Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
And she came to live with me when her partner was at his wit's end and couldn't do it anymore, and lived with me for about a year and a half. And during that year and a half, I wrote a private blog that only a few people could see, just so I had somebody I could talk to, because when you're taking care of someone with Alzheimer's disease, it's really, really difficult.
My hat's off to you. Yes.
And we were really to a critical place where my mother had to go into she needed to go into a long-term facility because she was getting increasingly more violent. Mm. And when I went to, my doctor said, oh, just go take her over to a Rio Grande care center. You know, so I go over there and they basically laugh at me and say, well, we have, a 5-year waiting list. And you go around to anyone and they say, well, we have a 5-year waiting list. And California just isn't, they're not ready for what's happening,
No.
And so I started talking to my siblings who lived in other states and said, how can you help me? There's, you have to do something. We can't do this, because we would take her to the hospital and they said, well, we can't help you. And I'd take her to the doctor. Well, we can't help you. And so now my mother is in a care facility in Indianapolis, Indiana, because in other states, they are prepared for this in much better ways than California is. For instance, there were 65 different nursing homes that took people who were low income on Medicare with a bed available when we searched in Indianapolis, Indiana. So fortunately, my sister lives in Indianapolis, Indiana, and we were able to take my mom to Indiana, where she's in a very high-quality care facility that is specifically for people with memory issues and connected to things like psychiatric facilities for elderly people. The quality of care there is just unbelievable. And for us, it turned out to be a solution to move her out of the state because we couldn't find any help. And while all the help we could find, friends would come over and Alzheimer's disease, would go to the support groups and write blogs. And, it's still in the end, you have to have some kind of care solution.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
Alexandra, this is Karen. You touch on a good point. I end up telling a lot of callers, do you have anybody in another area, a relative of it, almost any kind, that cares about your loved one who may be in an area with more resources than we have? Oregon, for instance, has a foster care program for seniors. It's basically like foster care for children, only, you get to live in the home with the family. It's not licensed exactly, but they can provide a lot of levels of that assistance, and it doesn't cost a whole lot. And other states do have something that they've done. Every state's got a failure somewhere. Every state's got a success somewhere. But there are other states that are just doing a much better job than we are here. And I don't know if it's just the economy of scale. We have a lot of seniors in our areas.
Well, we also, if you look at it too, I think I read not too long ago that 1 out of 9 U.S. citizens living in America lives here in California. So just by the nature of the bulk of the number of aging, we have the plethora of individuals here, and so the resources are vastly taxed.
Yeah, but it is an option that we tell people if you do have someone, and it's sad because you shouldn't need to move your loved one to Indianapolis. We should have something here.
Yes,
but that's not the reality I'm living in right now.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm so glad.
I'd also like to give out to the program that we went to. There was a really nice daycare that we went to in Santa Maria, and Right On had a connection here, so from San Luis Obispo, they would pick her up every morning and take her to Santa Maria, and we did that until she got advanced to a point where she couldn't do that anymore.
Yes, and CAPSLO also has a program up in North County, in Paso Robles as well, and it's a day treatment program. So, there are some resources that are available. It's sometimes very difficult to access. And sometimes it's not suited for the seniors where it doesn't work. Were you still trying to work while caring for your mom?
I was still trying to work, but my daughter, we hooked into the IHSS system, so they paid my daughter to stay home with her while I worked. And my daughter's 21, so she moved home to help me, which was really nice. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
You have a wonderful day.
Okay, thanks. What about, so that, you know, that is not an uncommon story. I mean, you were nodding your head as Alexander was talking. It's is pretty familiar one to you.
It is. You know, people looking for those solutions and those waiting lists, like I mentioned earlier, it's tough. And I don't want to, you know, like Alexandra mentioned, there are services out there. There's things that can be done. It's easier when you have a younger person who is not 70 or 80 with their own health problems to coordinate those services,
right,
to contact Ride On, to contact adult day centers, to find those nutrition programs or the, you know, to work with in-home supportive services to get on their system. It's easier, a lot easier. But where I'm seeing the failures in particular is when you don't have that person who is able to make those coordinations for you. It just keeps it just causes so many troubles. You just really need that coordination to happen. And it's hard when I get calls from somebody who's not doing well coordinating, and I just want to get them the help they need, but where do I send them?
Yeah. How important is it to be prepared ahead of time for healthcare changes, and what can people do to do that?
Oh, it's very important. But there are some limits because we can't anticipate everything that can happen to us.
Sure.
You know, that's just the nature of living. You don't always know what's around the next corner. But certainly having healthcare directives, having a pulse if you maybe within the, you know, possibly a year of the of end of life.
Which is a physician order for life-sustaining treatment.
Yeah, sorry. I try not to acronym, but I obviously did. Having legal documents that say who's going to make your decisions. And having conversations about what decisions you want made for you. What are your preferences? What are your wishes? You know, for myself, if I sustain a terrible brain injury, I really want no treatment. That's something I choose for myself. But if I don't get that to my healthcare agents, the people who will make decisions if I'm unable, they might not know that. And they might think, well, we should do everything we can and, you know, toss all the books at her. Make sure you treat with everything possible. And that may go against my wishes. So it's nice to have the document, but the conversation is even more important because the document lets people make decisions. The conversation makes sure that people are going to make your decisions, not their own.
When family members have power of attorney over an elder, do they have all decision-making power?
They don't. A lot of people think if you've got healthcare power or you've got financial power over somebody, that's it. You
control them.
You've got the keys to the world.
Yeah.
It's not true. There are things that are healthcare decisions. For instance, are you going to have a surgery or not? That's a healthcare decision. Are you going to take a medication or not? That's a healthcare decision. Are you going to have a visitor or not? Is somebody who maybe is kind of a difficult, icky person in your life going to be able to come see you? That's a right. That is not a healthcare or financial decision. And only the person. So if you were my agent, Chris, and you said, no, your friend is just yucky to deal with and we don't like her, then you don't get to control that. I still, no matter how demented I am or how incompetent, I would still have that decision to make for myself because it's my right to see visitors. And there's a lot of things that are rights. If truly I have a bad visitor, then you could go to a judge and get a restraining order. But you need a judge's permission or my permission to change that issue. So it doesn't give you carte blanche. You don't become, you know, ruler of all things you see, but it does give you enough power to make sure that healthcare or financial decisions are made, hopefully in the wishes of the person who's you're doing them for.
So as an ombudsman, then you're really protecting the patient's rights overall, not just their rights within the institution, about the institution. You're looking at protecting their rights, and that's rights that the family may impose themselves on too.
Yeah, that's kind of our bread and butter, really, is resident rights. We have a lot of posters about it. We do a lot of education about it. We actually even have a bingo game about resident rights. It's actually pretty fun. But yeah, people, you know, we always want different things. I wish my mother would fry less things in her cast iron skillet. It's not healthy. She drinks an awful lot of Starbucks white chocolate mochas, not particularly healthy. And then she takes her cholesterol medicine. We joke about that. She says, oh, here I'm taking my cholesterol medicine with my white chocolate mocha. There's things I wish she would do differently. There's things that people would wish I would do differently. But I still have my rights. I can still do my things, even if somebody in my life doesn't maybe like that as much.
What, when you're looking at what you would want to direct people, if you wanted to give people really some suggestions about seeking care for frail elderly adults, what are some of the key tips that you feel like are important for people to understand?
I think people need to know there's a lot less resources than they're probably thinking there are, and it's really important to do a lot of research.
So start earlier.
Start as early as you can. You know, don't start when someone's 50. You know, you don't need to start looking for a nursing home today if you don't need one for 20
that'll
years.
That'll probably tick them off.
If my kids start looking for a nursing home for me, we'd have some words. But, you know, make sure you start the process early. Have good, healthy conversations. That's the really important part with families. If you can't have healthy conversations, you know, 20 years ago, having them now about mom or dad having health issues is going to probably go poorly. Get to a counselor. Get to a family counselor and figure out a method for all the relatives who can possibly participate to have healthy conversations that don't lead to blame and yelling and dysfunction, because that makes the price tag of all this go up significantly and causes so much grief and harm. So it's really important to be healthy in your conversations. Get help if you need with that, with counseling, with mediation. And then, you know, call the ombudsman office. Even if you're not looking at long-term care, we will make sure you get steered to the right place. We really don't want people feeling like they're on their own. It's very important that people get started down the right track as quickly as possible for the best outcomes. So if it's not something that we can help you with, we will make sure you at least get one phone number of an agency who's likely to be able to help you with whatever ails you or what you need.
In terms of people's long-term care insurance, are there some misunderstandings that they have about what that will pay for?
There are, and there's a lot of – there's some good long-term care policies out there, and there's some really bad ones. In fact, there's a couple out there that are really old policies, and I've actually directed people to call the insurance commissioner because they were selling unicorns. And, you know, as we know, unicorns don't seem to exist. The policy will only cover a facility, a 12-bed or more residential care facility where there's a registered nurse on duty 24 hours a day. That doesn't exist. That has never existed.
Say that again.
So the policy will have conditions that aren't realistic, that don't exist in the licensing world.
Okay. So they'll cover, but what they're covering is something that they would never pay for because it doesn't exist.
Right.
Okay.
So people, you know, I hate to use the word fraud, but I tell people call the insurance commissioner because it looks like they paid a lot of premium dollars for something that they can never get a benefit from. And if there's a method to fix that, I want the insurance commissioner to help them with that. Mm-hmm. But there are policies out there that will pay for the care or part of the care, and that does help a lot. So if it's not going to mean that you don't eat, I say talk to an insurance broker who sells them, a reputable one. Talk to HICAP. It's the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program.
And they're free.
And it's free, and they don't sell. And all they will do is tell you all about long-term care policies and what you're looking for. And then they'll send you off to find an agent of your choice, being better informed. If you already have a policy, they'll look at it. They'll tell you what you've got, what it's going to pay for. It's worth looking into if you can afford to do it. It is a pricey policy because obviously it's a pricey cost.
Right.
If you do need to use that insurance.
And then having an understanding that should you ever need in-home care with somebody coming to your home to help you either with bathing or with any kind of round-the-clock care, that's not currently paid for by Medicare, and it doesn't look like it will be.
I would doubt it. There is in-home supportive services, which will cover some of that cost, but you have to be very low income for that. You have to qualify for Medi-Cal. You have to meet the needs requirements. They do an assessment, and you may or may not get the services you feel you need.
Mm-hmm.
So there is help if you're very low income.
And can you own a home and qualify for that?
You know, I'm not sure on the specifics on that.
Okay. So do you ever suggest to people that they may want to start doing, you know, we do holiday accounts, to do a rainy day account for those kinds of things?
I do. I mean, I think it's important to sort of plan, you know, for your future needs. It's mm-hmm. important to save. Again, we've come out of a pretty hard recession. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's bounced back. People have lost homes. People have lost nest eggs. It's important to save. It's important to plan for ourselves and to plan to care for ourselves, because I have to say, I just don't think the government's ever going to provide the services that you want. If you need services, you might need to make sure you're in a position to take care of them yourselves or coordinate that with your family to help out. But I think to count on the government to fix it all, you're probably not going to be happy with the solution that the government comes up with.
In talking with Alexandra, who called in, one of the things that she mentioned was the pooling of the resources. They kind of did it at the end when it was like exhaustive of, we have to find another solution, looking at family members that were in other states. But that also is probably on an earlier end of looking at the resources of what can we do, especially if you're living locally or living in California. It may be for right now, if 95% of the beds are filled and there are waiting lists, maybe look at what other alternatives there are for another relative to give assistance.
Right. Of course, then you have to leave the area, which, you know, we move here because we love the weather,
right.
Although it should be nice if it rained. And we, you know, we just love this area. And, you know, would I want to move to L.A. in case I happen to need long-term care at some point and can find a bed down there? I don't know. I think I'd rather stay here and take my chances. But maybe if I want to stay here, I might need to move closer into town and not be in a completely rural area where I can't get home-delivered meals.
Right.
Maybe I need to think about the fact that I can't get home health or hospice if I live in Creston or in some of the smaller communities.
Really remote areas.
Because then, you know, I may be able to stay here in this area, but maybe not exactly where I'd like to be, you know, at that point. Or, you know, the horror, you know, if you live south of the grade, you may have to go over the grade and live in a nursing home or a care facility in the north of the grade. And, you know, worse, if you're north of the grade, come south. You know, we don't like to travel up and down the grade here. It's pretty funny, but
right.
It is a reality. We have to maybe be flexible.
So if people wanted to contact you, if family members had questions, how would they get a hold of you?
The easiest way is to call. You can call 805-785-0132. Now, we also have a website, and it's interesting. Lately, almost every caller has said, well, I'm looking at your website while they're talking to me. So there are some resources on there. There's lists of care facilities. There's healthcare directives. And we're always adding to the website. So if there's something you see that's not there, let me know. And that's ombudsmanslo.org.
Okay. Great. And I want to thank Karen Jones, Executive Director and Program Manager for Long-Term Care Ombudsman of San Luis Obispo County. And for the callers that called in today, Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellard Sargent. On a final note, that making a donation to KCBX is an investment that gives you something back 24/7. Please consider your support by calling 805-549-8855 or making a donation online at kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington. Thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices. Join Fred Monroe next week.